The Afghan capital, stronghold of President Najibullah's regime, awaits the Mujahideen onslaught. Kabul now encircled not only by the Hindu Kush mountains, but by a ring of firepower, keeping the rebels out for the time being, at least. Afghan soldiers now stand guard on the entrance to the military airfield, the last post to be vacated by the departing Russians. United Nations observers searched the base, satisfying themselves that the last Soviet soldier had gone.
We didn't lift up every manhole cover.
We didn't lift up every manhole cover, the officer said, but there are no Russians here. The city has been going about its business as usual, but posters showing bloodthirsty Mujahideen carrying gruesome trophies reflect the nervousness caused by rumours that 30,000 rebels are about to launch an offensive on the city. In Chicken Street, Kabul's famous shopping centre, the traders were still manning their stores, refusing to allow talk of war to interfere with business.
Are you frightened now?
No. The city is open. The people come to the their shops. You know, I don't know yet.
Our military is very strong, huh? You think the army will keep the Mujahideen out there?
Huh? It's not Mujahideen here in the moment.
They're not here at the moment, but are you scared they'll come?
No, I don't think so.
Are you scared, afraid of what might happen here?
I never afraid. I belong to my Allah. I never afraid for everything. I belong to my Allah as a God.
Emerging from the dust of the Salang Highway, bringing relief to the city, a convoy of trucks carrying desperately needed fuel, munitions, and food. Petrol supplies are now so low, it's impossible to buy fuel, even at inflated black market prices. The government claims the 300-vehicle convoy had been held up for almost a week by fighting, but finally made it after a major military operation to clear the Mujahideen from the mountains alongside the highway. As the armoured convoys headed up the Salang Highway, they passed truckloads of refugees from the fighting, heading in the opposite direction. The government believes some of these settlements have been giving help and shelter to the rebels. The official line is that these villages are being cleared for the safety of the people who live there. But the decision has also been taken to clear areas that are being used by the Mujahideen for their attacks on Kabul. Hundreds of homeless people will be heading towards the capital, where there's already a shortage of housing, as well as food and medical supplies. The daily food queues testify to the effectiveness of the rebel blockade of Kabul. Children wait for hours in the freezing early morning to buy bread for their families. The crisis in Kabul is shockingly illustrated in the malnutrition unit of the Indira Gandhi Children's Hospital. A week ago, only half the beds were occupied. Today, the unit's full. A baby boy died in the night. The bed was empty for less than an hour before another tiny casualty of this war arrived. A chronic shortage of protein and dairy produce means this two-year-old girl weighs 5 kilograms. Less than half the weight of a healthy child. Half of these children are not expected to recover. Pathetic victims of a local war funded by the world's superpowers. All they understand is the pain of hunger and dying. The irony is there is food on sale in the Kabul bazaar, but shortages have forced prices up beyond the reach of the poor. Meat is available, but at black market prices, 3 times what they were last year. Kabul's hospitals are already full of victims of the war. Overworked medical teams fear a new rush of casualties should the expected Mujahideen offensive take place. In the children's hospital, the crisis now means 2 little patients to a bed. Each week, victims of rocket attacks that fall on civilian areas and children whose parents simply can't afford to feed them the protein they need to survive are dying here. Hospitals are now running out of the most basic supplies. The families of patients have to provide their own bandages.
It's a day-to-day struggle to keep the operations going.
On the mountainsides outside the city, government soldiers searching for and finding mines. but other mines are found by unlucky civilians. Tazagur, a teenage peasant, was working land outside the city when a mine blew off his leg. His brother Rashid ran to help, stood on another mine, and also lost a leg. Lieutenant General Fazl Alumi, the army commander on the government central committee, says despite the high price in casualties, Kabul will not fall.
Our armed forces are capable of not only defending Kabul city, but in case it is needed, it can give help to the surrounding area of Kabul, that is to the province of Kabul as a whole.
This is one of President Najibullah's answers to the Russian withdrawal and the gaps it leaves in Kabul's defenses. Female party members have been encouraged to join neighborhood militia units. The government claims to have 500,000 men and women under arms, but many of those we've seen are clearly untrained in the use of weapons. Despite all the weaponry supplied by the Russians, the greatest ally of the Najibullah regime today is probably the weather, the harshest winter for 16 years, making life difficult for their own forces, but almost impossible for the Mujahideen to make a concerted move on the capital. Most people here believe it will be spring before the Mujahideen come down from the mountains, and the readiness and the loyalty of President Najibullah's troops is really put to the test. On a bright winter morning, you could almost forget that Kabul is a city surrounded by hostile forces. Hundreds gathered in the central bazaar. Only the black market prices and the fact that every other person appeared to be in uniform to remind you that the city's under siege. But in a desolate graveyard on the outskirts of the city, a harsh reminder. A mother whose soldier's son has been killed by the rebels gives vent to her grief and her anger at both sides in a war that's filled so many graveyards.
This whole struggle has been about self-determination, and it has entered another stage now, and so we will continue to be supportive of the Afghan people as they pursue that.
There is a danger that they could turn their guns against each other and plunge Afghanistan into a civil war.
We understand that the Soviets are basically out of Afghanistan, and we are glad for that.
We will do what we need to do to see that there is a peaceful resolution of this question, that one side does not dominate militarily, and we will be encouraging reconciliation.
With the Soviets out of Afghanistan, the world watches and waits for what happens next. The State Department says whatever sort of government emerges will be determined by the Afghans.
We have supported the various ideas that have been put forward as the Afghan people have tried to address this issue of their future. And we will continue to do that. But as always, we ourselves will not be proposing a blueprint. This whole struggle has been about self-determination.
But a new government will have to wait until after the expected overthrow of the communist regime of Najibullah.
It's not whether, but when. And I give it no more than a few months. What concerns me is what will happen after the overthrow of the Najib government in Kabul. If the victorious Afghans do not agree among themselves on a broad-based government that has the support of the commanders inside the country and the Afghan population at large, then I think there is a danger that they could turn their guns against each other and plunge Afghanistan into a civil war.
Indeed, the Mujahideen do not seem to be savoring their victory over the Soviets. Instead, rebel leaders meeting in Pakistan are squabbling over who will head an interim government.
The purpose of the long-awaited Shura is to elect an interim Afghan government in exile. Armed Mujahideen, untypically wearing uniform, guarded the gate and vetted all arrivals. With so many rival factions and the possibility of sabotage by the Kabul regime, security was tight. But many Afghans disagree with the Shura. These people want the former king, Zahar Shah, to head an interim government, to the violent disapproval of the extremists. They attack the monarchists with sticks and clubs. The oldest of the seven alliance leaders, Mr. Yunis Khalis, has his doubts about the Shura. He's concentrating his efforts across the border in Nangarhar, where he's the strongest. He was there recently rallying his troops for the attack on Jalalabad. No one knows how long the Shura is going to last, nor what it will achieve, if anything. But the general feeling persists that this is largely a cosmetic exercise. Pakistan is the driving force behind the Shura. The Russians lost interest when the Mujahideen refused to accept any communist delegates. The leaders themselves are divided, which is not unusual. One told me the Shura was a farce. But the chaotic opening of the meeting was due not to the Afghans, but to the television crews and the press who threatened to disrupt the whole proceedings. As security men tried vainly to restore order, the 500 delegates sat impassively before finally seeking inspiration from the Quran.
The U.S., says a former ambassador to Afghanistan, must take a hands-off approach.
There isn't a great deal we can do. What we can do, we are doing. We're trying together with the Pakistanis, the Saudis, to try and persuade these quarreling politicians in Peshawar, rather than the commanders, but also them, to get together and form some kind of a coalition.
After the Mujahideen ultimately win in Kabul, I think you'll see a fairly weak central government, because historically that has been the case in Afghanistan. And you'll see most of the power based in regional commanders and tribal elders who have proven themselves to be efficient during the 9-year war inside the country.
U.S. policy goals for Afghanistan include its restoration to independent, non-aligned status, self-determination for the Afghan people, return of the refugees, and reconstruction. Officials say the U.S. must avoid being identified with any one of the 15 rebel groups, lest the others turn against the U.S., forgetting that American aid, especially the sophisticated Stinger rockets, helped make their victory possible.
Whatever sort of government emerges in Kabul, observers agree that an Iran-style fundamentalist state is not likely, since Shia Muslims are in the minority. What concerns U.S. officials more is how the Afghan rebels conduct themselves in the coming months. Their worry is that having won the war, the Mujahideen are in grave danger of losing the peace.
Basically, the Soviets left Afghanistan because they were defeated.
Long, constantly bunching up, then thinning out, to concentrate firepower at danger points along the 300-mile route to the Soviet border.
The mood among these Soviet soldiers is one of immense relief at getting out unscathed. They won't stop now until the Soviet border. This is their last glimpse of Afghanistan.
When they first came down this road in December 1979, few Russians realized it would take more than 9 years to get back again. Afghanistan has been a Soviet military nightmare.
The Soviets sought a military conquest and sought to impose a particular regime in a colonial style, and the Afghan people resisted, and they have suffered a major defeat.
Fighting guerrilla armies in their own mountains bogged down a Soviet superpower as surely as it did the 19th century British army. Now, these returning Soviet soldiers will bring with them an Afghanistan syndrome, the fallout of thwarted military ambition, the social pressures of readjustment to home life. In a society now encouraged to question its history, many Soviets will ask of Afghanistan, what was it all for? Military helicopters shadowed the convoy on its last leg, soldiers' radios interrupting our television pictures. Ground the slower pace of Afghan rural life that's now seeing the Soviet military machine pull out. Among the tanks and armored cars in this convoy, missile transporters, which may have delivered the non-nuclear Scud rockets to the Afghan army last year. One Soviet driver was relieved to be home. Afghanistan was a local war, he said. They should be able to sort it out for themselves. They'd reached the Soviet border with Afghanistan, marking the end of a military adventure Moscow will want to forget. In a Moscow apartment, young Russians celebrate one soldier's freedom from Afghanistan. Dmitry Vyshenko has just left hospital after being blown off his feet by a mine near Kabul. His medals display the bravery shown in action in Afghanistan. Dmitry got out alive, but some of his friends did not. Now they were remembered. No one here is over 25. This is the Afghanistan war generation. The brunt of the fighting, the burden of waiting was theirs. Now they must live with a society that knows Afghanistan was not a Soviet success. Night after night on TV news, Soviets are seeing their army as they've never done before. Struggling home through the Salang Tunnel, in retreat and in trouble. It's all a shock to a country whose military tradition is not based on withdrawal. In Moscow, Katya Tolkacha treasures the love letters and photographs of a newlywed husband, fearing for his safety in Afghanistan. Now he's out, but not home. There's no remission for fighting the war. Conscripts like Sergei now complete their army service inside Soviet borders. Meanwhile, this powerful documentary is shocking Soviets, showing how thousands of young soldiers were injured by cluster bombs and mines in Afghanistan. Some will carry lifelong scars from a war started by another Kremlin generation. It means for the first time Soviet families are grieving for sons lost in a conflict that's not universally admired at home. Even gravestones avoid the word Afghanistan. It says this 20-year-old died fulfilling his international duty, the standard term for a war today's Russia wants to forget. The war cost nearly 15,000 young Soviet lives, yet so uncomfortably does Afghanistan sit in Soviet society that this modest stone in the northern Moscow suburbs is all that marks their passing.
The Scars of War, the big story this week. This is Don Miller, CNN.